Today on the program, we're going to be reviewing the book entitled Before the World Intruded. The subtitle, Conquering the Past and Creating the Future. The book is written by Michelle Rosenthal. Michelle, welcome to the Ink Spot.
Hey, Stanley. Good evening. Thank you so much for having me tonight.
There is an image that you return to in the book at least twice, the image of a zebra. In fact, you refer to yourself as a zebra. Tell us what that is.
I do, and that links actually to what happened to me in 1981. So let me first explain 1981, and then the zebra will make total sense. Because in 1981, I was just a 13-year-old girl, had a run-of-the-mill infection, was given a very common antibiotic, and what happened next was anything but common. Due to an unknown allergy that I had to the medication, I ended up with a very rare, life-threatening illness that none of my New York City doctors had ever seen. And effectively, it turned me into a full-body, third-degree burn patient. So I lost 100% of my epidermis. And here's where the zebra comes in.
Before you go to the zebra, you said you lost 100% of your epidermis, and that is the outer layer of skin?
Yes.
The skin itself came off.
It all came off.
Wow.
It did.
So you're going to say about the zebra?
So about the zebra, in the medical profession, a zebra is the most unexpected thing. When you go, the story goes, when you go into a barn, you expect to see a horse, but sometimes there's a zebra. And in the medical profession, a zebra is any of those unexpected illnesses or things that the body does that you've never seen before, that you don't expect to see, and it, you know, and I referenced in Before the World Intruded a little quote by a doctor about why zebras are so exciting to doctors. It rekindles in them their experience of the mysteries of the body. And so I refer to myself as a zebra and a freak because nobody had ever seen what was wrong with me. And so the zebra became a symbol of how unusual my illness was.
While you were in the hospital trying to recover, a couple of things that you talked about in the book, which kind of made my skin crawl. One is this idea that you developed blisters all over your entire body, causing your skin to fall off. And then you talked about how you were in the hospital bed and your body was almost attached to the sheets. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Think about any time you've ever had a blister. I know I'm a dancer, so I get lots of blisters on my feet now because I dance in shoes that don't fit right or whatever it is. Think about the last time you had a blister on your foot from shoes that rub too much. That skin, it puffs up, right? The blister itself puffs up,
right.
and then the fluid gets released, and then there's that flap of skin that needs to come off so that the blister itself, the skin underneath, can heal. And that is effectively the process that my whole body went through, except the blisters that I had were, enormous instead of what's small and on the back of your heel.
You said that you developed this disease, or was it a disease, an infection? What exactly was it?
It's an illness. It's an allergic reaction. And so it's not a disease because it actually can be cured, and the illness runs its own course. So if you wait long enough, it actually works its way out of the body. They think that it has to do, the illness is called toxic epidermal necrolysis syndrome, and it can actually come from, I've spoken to many survivors now of it, and ibuprofen can be the simple thing that sets off a body. Just depends on your sensitivity, and what they think happens is that the body cannot metabolize the antibiotic, and so it just sends it out through the skin, much in the same way as it does the chicken pox, sends the virus, it causes an eruption in the skin. It's the same kind of idea.
In your instance, it was caused by an allergic reaction?
Yes.
An allergic reaction
to the medication.
Can anybody get this?
Absolutely.
The title of the book is Before the World Intruded. Tell us, what do you mean by the world intruding?
Oh, Stanley, I was just a happy-go-lucky kid. Having the best summer of my 13-year-old life, my family had You know, there were four of us, my little brother, my parents, and I. We had rented a 26-foot Winnebago and flown from New York to Arizona, and we're driving all over the West, going to the Painted Desert and the Grand Canyon and all of these beautiful, wonderful, exciting places. So we were having a great summer. And then I came home, and suddenly I had this horrific thing happen to me, and I titled the book Before the World Intruded because it had such significance to me. My whole life changed because of that one experience, that experience of having this trauma occur. And I spent so much time after that trying to get back to who I was before the world intruded, before the world came into my happy little place and changed everything forever. I just wanted to pretend it didn't happen. And so if I could act like the girl I was before my illness, if I could laugh the way she did, if I could talk the way she did, if I could behave the way she did, I thought if I faked it enough, I could go back to that girl. Because after my trauma, I went from being this happy-go-lucky kid to being very melancholic and insomniac. I had nightmares. I was anxious all the time. And I was full of anger and rage.
What do you think produced that? Do you think it was because of the experience itself, or because of the memories of the experience, or because you were afraid that that could happen again?
Yes to all the above. Mm. I think every single one of those things that you said is so spot on. I think, yes, I definitely walked with a very clear presence of danger, knowing that my body could surprise me at any moment and do that again. And I was terrified of that. I wouldn't even take a Tylenol if I had a headache because I was so afraid of what would happen. So when you move through the world from that perspective, it becomes very difficult to accept what's happened to you. And so you just keep trying to have it be something else.
Now, you said that in the book that people tend to disconnect from the present moment. What do you mean by that?
Well, dissociation is very common for trauma survivors. The need to, it's a really a coping mechanism, the need to detach from the emotions and the intensity of the present moment. And so in dissociation, we just sort of remove ourselves, go someplace else in your head so that your body is physically present, but your mind just drifts off. And in coping after trauma, in terms of feeling safe, feeling in control, dealing with that overwhelming emotion, it becomes much easier to disconnect rather than to try to figure out how am I going to be present with this intense, overwhelming, terrifying emotion.
You had many ordeals in the book, many physical challenges, emotional challenges. You went in and out of depression and other illnesses. Ultimately, you were diagnosed as having post-traumatic stress disorder. What is that?
Well, we mostly, so often in the media, we hear about post-traumatic stress disorder in terms of our combat veterans. And so maybe everybody is familiar with the idea of you go to war and you come back, and because of these horrific things that you've experienced, you feel some kind of anxiety and stress. And so post-traumatic stress disorder, in terms of the whole world, it's not just combat veterans. It happens to people who survive any kind of trauma. Post-traumatic stress disorder literally is a clinical diagnosis that comes after you've survived a trauma in which you felt helpless and in which your physical being was in life-threatening danger. And really what it is it's a survival mechanism that kicks in the subconscious mind and in the body to keep you safe, and then just doesn't know when to stop. So it's almost as if you come through the trauma and then your body and your mind continue to behave as if the traumatic event is still happening. But it was my joy quest to be able to connect to that part of myself that you spoke of earlier, that ability to connect to the present moment. And to me, if I could access a part of myself that would feel joy, I would be able to be present. And if I could do that, then I figured I would be able to figure out how to move through the rest of my recovery. And the fantastic thing is that it worked, that feeling of joy became habitual for me. I woke up every day waiting to be able to go to my dance class and feel that way. And the more I connected to that place inside of me, the more I believed in myself, the more confidence I developed in myself, the more courage I had to go back and make one more attempt at recovery and freedom. And it was that final attempt that got the job done.
About the idea of God. Now, at one point, there's two things that's coming to my mind right now. Number one is you said that you did not believe in God. Number two, you said that during your ordeal back in 1981, you went through a tunnel, a black tunnel. And we've heard this type of conversation many times in the past, but apparently you were experiencing a death, do you think?
To me, that's what it felt like. Definitely, I there was a moment where I just felt the most peaceful disassociation, actually, in that moment, detachment from my body, and I felt myself lift up after, out of it. And it's funny because last week, a woman who's read my memoir, Before the World Intruded, said to me, you know, I did die from anaphylactic shock, and they brought me back. And the way you describe that scene where you leave your body and go into that tunnel, that's exactly what it's like. So, yes, moving into the tunnel was enormously peaceful. I loved it. I felt so safe. I felt such an enormous amount of universal energy. And I felt such a heightened consciousness of my own self as an energy, as a soul. It was beautiful and it was wonderful. And it was also very clear to me in that moment, whatever it was that I was experiencing, I was very much alone. I was very much, you know, you brought up the idea of God, and that I came out of this trauma not believing in anything outside of myself. And I think that had a lot to do with the fact that I felt very alone in my trauma. Now, my parents were phenomenal. They were there. I wasn't technically alone. But in the moments where I needed strength, in the moments where I needed help to find a way to live through the hell that I was in, I was very alone inside my own head and very alone inside needing to find my own strength. And that really changed my perception of God and religion, because I had always thought, in my moments of need, there would be something there. And my experience was that there was only me. It changed my perspective on things.
Do you still feel that today?
You know, Stanley, I never did change that feeling. And at the same time, I never tried to either, because as a part of my healing journey, and we're all different, you know, my parents came out of this, they were there through the whole thing. They have a much stronger, much deeper belief in God, because they believe it's God who saved me. So I think, you know, two people can go through the same thing, and just based on your own experience and what you do with that experience in your own mind, two people would have two totally different ideas at the end of the same moment.
Yeah, we appreciate you spending some time with us here to discuss your book. We've been talking with Michelle Rosenthal regarding her book, Before the World Intruded. Michelle, what is the best way for the audience to get a copy of the book?
Oh, the best way is the launch and release of the book is tomorrow, and you can go to beforetheworldintruded.com. And I am so excited, Stanley, because so much of my mission today is to help people not suffer the way I did for so long with PTSD and with trauma in general. My story had such a happy ending, and the book goes through such a wonderful resilience and redemption at the end. And I want that for everybody. So beforetheworldintruded.com tomorrow.
Michelle Rosenthal, thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
We will be right back on the Ink Spot after this break. We are going to be at the round table. Okay, we're back on the Ink Spot. I am Stanley G. Robertson. We're talking about the book, Before the World Intruded, by Michelle Rosenthal. We're up at the round table. I'm joined by my guest, Benita Jackson. Benita's a regular contributor to the Ink Spot. Benita, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Stan.
Also joined by Lewis W. Powell III. Lewis is an attorney. He's a principal at Exodus Development Company. He's also an adjunct professor at the John Marshall Law School. Lewis, welcome to the Ink Spot.
Stan, thanks for having me.
All right, Benita, what do you think about the book Before the World Intruded?
Stan, this lady is living my ultimate fear in life, and that is to be sickly. I was turning the pages trying to figure out what was going to happen to this lady next, and I had to keep a log of all the different illnesses that she went through. I think it's an excellent medical journal.
Lewis, what do you think?
Stan, this was a hard read. I kept going through the book waiting for this lady to turn the corner, and then eventually she did turn the corner toward the end of the book.
All right. Yeah, I thought Before the World Intruded was a very interesting book. And as a matter of fact, when I first started to read the book, I thought that I was going to have some problems reading it. I didn't think I would enjoy it at all. But it turns out that she had a very intriguing and interesting story. As you mentioned, Benita, her illnesses did overwhelm her life. She went in and out of depression as well as many other illnesses. Do you think this woman was a hypochondriac?
I think she was. I really do think she was, and I don't want to minimize any pain that she's been through, but just based on the story and the support that she had, I just didn't see it was any reason for her to continue going the route, the way that she was going.
What do you think about that, Lewis? Hypochondriac or no?
I think she might have been, but, you know, to her credit, she kept on soldiering on and eventually, found her level in terms of personal happiness.
Well, one of the things in regarding her personal happiness, as we mentioned earlier, is the dancing. She said she found joy in dancing, and I thought that was pretty good. But another thing that she worked on before she ultimately found her joy was hypnosis. What did you make of that?
Well, first, before you talk about the hypnosis, even in dancing, you found that she would have to go sit on a bench because then her feet hurt throughout the night.
Right.
This lady was consistently going through pain. It was just too much.
So you're saying even when she was looking for her joy, that was pain in the joy?
Yes. Somebody had to rub her feet. My goodness, come on. So she just went through a lot.
Well, I don't know, Benita. You know, when the guy rubbed her feet, that seemed to be something really good because that led to some good feelings for her and a good relationship.
Yeah, well, this is true. So that did kind of guide her into something else. But, you know, the book ended there, so we don't know what happened from that point on. But we know as of the end, this man was nice enough to rub her feet, and a relationship was born from that. So
now, okay, so what do you make of the hypnotist? Did you get the sense, Lewis, what do you think about this? Did you get the sense that the hypnotism was a good thing?
Yeah, because it looked like to me that's when she really started to, get her breakthrough. Her mini breakthrough was the dancing. It seemed like the hypnotist was able to, you know, reach inside her soul and draw things out of her.
You believe in hypnotism?
I've never been hypnotized, but I hear it works.
Now, what do you think, Benita?
Based on what I hear, I don't think it necessarily works, but I think that she was dependent on something to help her. And so she kind of looked into different treatments, and hypnotherapy was the one that she kind of set her mind on, hypnotherapy for post-traumatic syndrome. So she knew what she was looking for, and whether it worked or not, I think that was just the turning point.
Do you believe that this was more psychological than anything else?
I do. I don't know if this lady did anything for her. I think that it was just something that she wanted to happen, and so she went through therapy with this young man named Greg for, it seemed like forever, and nothing ever happened for her. And she talked about Greg like he did her some good. But this hypnotherapy, it was one session, and she's cured. Hallelujah.
Well, that was a good thing because remember she had talked to another hypnotist before she made her final decision. And he said he could cure her in one session.
That's right. And she was kind of going back and forth because she didn't necessarily believe him and believe. She was really comfortable with this lady. But she was still kind of skeptical because she tried it in college. And in college, she kind of laughed it off and didn't think it would necessarily work. So she was a little skeptical herself.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about hypnotism, but according to Michelle Rosenthal, hypnotism was a very good thing for her, and it did help to bring her out. Now, in terms of how hypnotism worked for her, she said that 88% of the brain is your subconscious, and then 12%, I suppose, is the conscious areas of the brain. And that 88% of the brain is where the hypnotism will reach. And it'll go in there and help you. It doesn't help you forget about the bad feelings, the trauma that she went through, but it did, according to her, help her to redirect her feelings. In other words, make her not feel so bad and traumatized by those particular events that occurred in her life.
And basically made her, it seems like she wasn't going to be the victim anymore. She didn't allow this one incident that occurred. Like I said, I know it was traumatic to her, so I don't want to minimize it in any way, but she didn't allow that one event to determine her life and her actions from that point forward.
Yeah, and that was definitely good, because apparently for some 20 years, she did allow that one event in 1981, when she was 13 years old. That single event seemed to dominate her entire life up until that point. I mean, did you get that sense?
I got that sense. I think it's a testimony that she did admit that she had a good support system. Her family was incredible. Her family stood by her thick and thin, even, you know, to the extent of relocating, which I thought was great. They relocated to another state, you know, for her benefit.
And see, Lewis, you thought that was great, but I thought it was very strange, because there were so many things that went on in this book that weren't necessarily explained. And I know that she was concentrating more on her post-traumatic syndrome that she went through, but just the things that her family did were seemingly remarkable.
But why did you think it was strange?
Because that's a pretty hard thing for people to do. And people aren't willing to move out their house. People aren't willing to move from one apartment to another. But for a family to say, yeah, we're going to move across, we're going to go to Florida and just live there and make it.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. I mean, her entire family, her brother, her mother and her father just up and moved to Florida. I didn't necessarily get the sense that was strange, but that was something that jumped out at me, that they did that.
When you have money, you can do that.
They had a lot of cash, because even when she was ill, there's some things that hospital didn't provide for her. But her parents were able to go out and get the burn unit bed that she needed, and they supplied whatever she needed in her illness that this hospital wouldn't provide for her.
Now, what did you guys make of this idea of the dark tunnel? She said that she had at one point the pain was so unbearable, and she just made up in her mind, wait a minute, I don't have to survive this. I can go ahead and just let go and die. And in fact, she then approached death. What did you make of that?
You know, I believe her. I think it's possible to get so down and, you know, so overwhelmed with physical or mental pain that you perhaps do give up and sort of submit yourself, you know, and say, you know, this is it. I'd rather, you know, go to another place than be where I'm at right now.
So you believe that in your mind you can will yourself to die?
I don't know about that, Stan. But
because that's essentially what that's,
you're right, though. But that's essentially what she said, because she had out-of-body experience.
Right, right. Yeah, she had an out-of-body experience. She was laying on the bed. She was in some excruciating pain, and she decided in her mind, I don't want to live anymore with this type of pain. No, I'm done.
I think when people come to a certain level of illness, that they have that right. I think they have that choice where they're just going to kind of let it go and they don't fight anymore. And I think that's what she did, was had given up her fight at that point, and then kind of redeemed herself and said, wait a minute, I still want to fight. But what's most disturbing about that is that her conversation speaks that she no longer, I guess, depends on God for that. And as a believer in God, I'm thinking only God brought you through this. Because she's saying she depended on herself the rest of her life. But when she depended on herself, she had insomnia, she had anorexia, she had this Epstein-Barr virus, she had fibromyalgia. And you're dependent on yourself. There's somebody else out there who's helping you through all this.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. She did say that she stopped believing in God. Now, at the time, she was 13 years old, but she said that her family was a religious family. She then stopped believing in God after the incident because she felt like she was left alone. Do you think that that is possible for someone to stop believing in God because they feel that God has abandoned them?
That's possible. I wouldn't recommend it. But, that is possible. Let's give this woman credit. She went through a tremendous amount of pain, physical and mental. And even those that have a high spiritual belief, it's possible even to have a high spiritual belief to get so down that you start, doubting, the Creator. And that is possible.
Yeah, because she said that when she was in the tunnel, it was a black tunnel with a light white ring around the tunnel at the other end, I suppose. But she said that while she was inside the tunnel, she did not see any angels. She felt extremely alone in the tunnel. I guess that'd be enough to shake you up, huh?
I guess, but how is that comforting?
But that's the problem. The problem is it wasn't comforting. And in this girl's mind at the time, she's a little girl. She's 13 years old. In her mind, she thinks that it ought to be comforting. If you, in fact, are going to die and you're going down this tunnel and God is waiting for you at the other end, wouldn't you think you should feel comfort?
Yeah, you would think so. I just think that she was going through a lot of confusion. Her family is very supportive. But as soon as she got out that hospital, I think that's when her therapy should have begun. But I think her parents kind of felt so bad with all that she went through, and when she said no, she didn't want to do it, they left it alone.
But remember, they said they didn't want to talk about it. She didn't want to talk about it, and I guess they tried to talk about it, but every time she just kind of snapped off and went ballistic, probably as a coping mechanism so that she would not have to talk.
And nobody knows how they'll act in that situation. Nobody knows because we haven't been there. But therapy would have been in order for her at the age of 13.
Yeah, I think therapy would have certainly made sense. I mean, anytime young folk go through things today, you see on the news all the time, something happened at their school, something happened in their family. They always provide them with some sort of
counseling,
therapy.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would make perfect sense. I'm not sure why she did not get therapy at the time, other than she was just so traumatized that she didn't want to talk about it. And I got the sense from reading the book that her family felt that kind of out of sight, out of mind, as long as you're not talking about it, maybe she's doing better.
Well, they kept promising her, if you make it through this, whatever you want. Once your ears pierced, we'll get your ears pierced. So I think they were just trying to somehow appease her and comfort her through this.
Yeah, that makes sense. We've only got a couple of minutes left on the program. What I want to find out from you guys, we've been talking about the book Before the World Intruded by Michelle Rosenthal. We want to know if you give the book a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Benita.
I'm going to give it a thumbs up for the medical professionals. For the rest of us, we don't need to go through this.
Lewis.
I'm kind of halfway up, halfway down, because this was a hard read. I'm just glad for her that she was able to make it and, find some level of sanity.
I'm going to give Before the World Intruded a thumbs up. I thought that the book was a really good book. You're right, some of the text was disturbing in her descriptions, but I thought it was a very intimate portrait of her struggle to overcome fear. She actually did overcome the fear. She triumphed over her trauma. So for that, I'm going to give her a thumbs up. The book also gave the readers a path to joy from depression. This woman was in and out of depression repeatedly, came out on the other end with flying colors. Benita Jackson has been our guest. Benita, we thank you for spending some time with us on the Ink Spot.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Lewis W. Powell III, thank you for being here.
Stan, thanks for the opportunity.